Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, John Roberts as first among equals on the Supreme Court and how he understands the U.S. Constitution and his own power as Chief Justice. We'll spend this hour with CNN legal analyst Joan Biskupic, who's written previous biographies of Sandra Day O'Connor, Antonin Scalia, and Sonia Sotomayor. We'll talk about how Roberts has ended up in the unlikely position of sitting at the ideological center of the court, and about how his influence has shaped affirmative action, voting rights, and health care policy. Our conversation starts after a short break. John Roberts is not to be underestimated. He's Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, of course, and these days he also sits at the ideological center of the nine justices. While he's not exactly a swing vote, he has crossed over for some consequential decisions, not least when he sided with the court's progressives in affirming the Affordable Care Act. And he seems to want to keep the court out of the fray of partisan politics.
We do not sit on opposite sides of an aisle. We do not caucus in separate rooms. We do not serve one party or one interest. We serve one nation.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Joan Biskupic is here to talk about how well John Roberts has managed to fulfill those goals of serving one nation. She's a legal analyst for CNN who's written previous biographies of Sonia Sotomayor, Antonin Scalia, and Sandra Day O'Connor. Her new book is called The Chief: The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. She joins us from NPR in Washington to talk about it. Joan, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
I want to start with this assertion we heard from the Chief Justice in the introduction, that he's made multiple times in different forms over the years. The court is not responsive to partisan politics and shouldn't be. Lots of people don't believe that's true. Is there any reason to doubt that Roberts does believe it?
No, and let's remind people of how he said it this time, because Chris, you're absolutely right that since the day that he was sworn in 2005, he has made that theme a prominent one in his leadership, that these justices are different from elected officials in the other two branches. But the statement you just read was made by Chief Justice John Roberts in October at the University of Minnesota, if I'm remembering right, soon after the very tumultuous confirmation hearing for Brett Kavanaugh.
Right.
And what the chief has feared is that if people see the kind of politics that surround a nomination and confirmation, they will necessarily think that any justice brings that political baggage to the bench. And I think that he felt a certain urgency after that episode that he wanted to reinforce his usual message. But to your question about whether, first of all, I would say he definitely believes it. I think, people believe what they say. But is it true? I think that it depends on individual justices in individual cases. We have seen ideological divisions on this court repeatedly, including on Monday in a case involving individual lawsuits against states where the justices divided with the five Republican-appointed conservatives against the four Democratic-appointed liberals. And there was a big fight over precedent, and there was some foreshadowing of a showdown on Roe v. Wade, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, Roe is really interesting from the perspective of someone like Roberts, who was raised Catholic. Is there any reason to believe that he would get behind a full-scale overturn of Roe, or are there likely to be actions that could weaken Roe v. Wade without requiring its elimination?
I am in the camp of the latter. But many of my colleagues think that we are in for a very direct assault on Roe v. Wade. And let me just tell you kind of that what the atmosphere is on that and just what the chances are from where I sit. First of all, things have changed because we have a president now, Donald Trump, who has vowed to appoint justices who would reverse the 1973 landmark, Roe v. Wade, that made abortion legal nationwide. And we have the new retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was a centrist conservative who always cast the fifth vote to uphold abortion rights. And just as you said in your introduction, Chris, John Roberts is now at the ideological center of the court, but he does not have the same regard for abortion rights that Justice Kennedy has. In fact, in the cases that he has actually ruled on involving abortion, he has voted for increased restrictions on it. But now that he's in this unusual spot, when the court is under such scrutiny as being political, and President Trump has certainly tried to politicize the judiciary, he has a new priority, and that's trying to steady the court and ensure that public regard for it doesn't drop.
So, in other words, I mean, lots of justices for lots of reasons might believe that the court should remain apolitical because that's the right thing to do morally. But Roberts is also thinking about the legitimacy of the court.
That is exactly right. I think he's thinking about the legitimacy and legacy of the court and, frankly, of his chief justiceship.
Is there reason to believe that he has made any decisions the way he has strictly because he's chief justice?
Well, the one I use in the book dates to 2012, and that was the momentous debate over the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
Just to remind all your listeners, that was President Barack Obama's signature domestic achievement. It came to the justices during an election year, and the Chief Justice actually ends up switching his vote behind the scenes to uphold that law. And it was a surprise to people at the time. And one thing I do in my book is recreate what was going on there. And I found out that the initial votes that the justices took on the two major planks of the Affordable Care Act, one having to do with that individual insurance requirement that was commonly referred to as the individual mandate, and the other having to do with expansion of Medicaid for poor people, that the chief had originally voted to strike down the individual mandate but uphold the Medicaid expansion, and in the end, through private negotiations, he flipped on both of those. And I think that whole episode added a new dimension to a man who's always talking about only looking at cases based on the law, or as he famously said in his 2005 confirmation hearings, calling just balls and strikes and just acting in the role of an umpire.
So what precipitated those switches, those flips? Talk about the sit-downs that he had with justices. It was Kagan and Breyer, right?
That's exactly right. And that would surprise people because here he is voting the initial vote, again, bringing everyone back to March of 2012, the initial vote after a historic 3 days of oral arguments. They're in their private conference room, a very ornate, beautiful room off the chambers of the chief, and they're going around the table voting, and the first vote is 5-4 to strike it down. And the chief is with the four other conservatives, again, you know, all the Republican appointees, to say, no, this cannot stand. And in fact, there was very strong sentiment by the centrist conservative, Anthony Kennedy, at the time, saying this whole law has to fail because we're invalidating this one key provision, the individual mandate. So the chief walks out of there, and meanwhile, the four liberals have dissented, and he's starts to write the opinion. He kept the majority opinion for himself, and he starts to believe that the whole law shouldn't go down. And Justice Kennedy is not going to play on that with him on that. He is firm that the whole law should fail, and the chief just does not want to take it down. Now, there are all sorts of factors in the atmosphere on this. You know, first of all, there were public expectations. It was an election year, 2012, a lot of tension among the justices, and there was a lot of commentary out in the air about, you know, what would happen. Would this Roberts court, you know, defy the Obama administration? You know, there's just so much swirling in the atmosphere. And his four fellow Republican appointees to his right did not want to deal on anything. They wanted the law to be totally struck down. And he starts to negotiate with Justices Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan, who of the four liberals, Chris, they're closest to the middle. They're most open to working with him on compromise, trying to bring about consensus. So he starts dealing mostly with them. And again, it's just behind the scenes. And that was a lot of fun for me to figure out what was going on, you know, who was up, who was down, who was mad. And there were so many tensions and tempers flaring. And it was what Roberts ends up doing as he switches his vote on the individual mandate is he subtly persuades Justices Breyer and Kagan to change their votes on the provision that would have enhanced Medicaid coverage for the poor. And so the end result, what we all saw at the end of June in 2012, was a ruling that by a 5-4 vote had upheld the individual mandate that everybody had to buy insurance, but by a 7-2 vote had struck down the Medicaid expansion. But we never knew about all the switches and multiple, you know, turns that led to it. And I think, to get to your question about his, you know, trying to bring about consensus, trying to be aware of the public atmosphere and the reputation of the court, I think those all fed into that. And I know people still approach him and thank him for that ruling. Now, you know, I'm sure that he might have mixed feelings about that kind of response. And he certainly had mixed feelings about the criticism from both the right and left that he had to endure after that. But I think it showed that he had these concerns about legitimacy and legacy that were interwoven with other concerns he might have had about, you know, exactly, you know, there is a principle at the court that if you can find a way to uphold a law, you know, do it. And in this case, instead of going with the grounds that everybody had been focused on, Congress's power to regulate commerce, he went with Congress's power, taxing power. Hmm. And that's what he hung the whole thing on. But just to add one final point, the whole court, the nine justices, had never voted in private on Congress's taxing power. He developed that out of his own set of arguments. The Obama administration lawyers had advocated the taxing power as sort of a subsidiary argument when they were in their oral arguments, but that had never been voted on by the nine.
So, Joan, I understand what you just said about Roberts, you know, focusing on the court's policy to uphold Congress's laws when possible, if allowed under the Constitution. But what you described to me, at least the scaffolding of it, of, you know, Justice Roberts sitting down with Justices Kagan and Breyer and talking this out, and he's sort of pushing them to switch on the Medicaid thing, and they're pushing him to switch on the aspect with regard to taxation. It sounds a lot like legislative deal making. Did Justice Roberts think about the practical consequences of the law itself as he was making these deals?
You know, It does smack of horse trading. I completely agree. But I think that what was going on was a little bit more subtle and implicit. When I talked to a majority of the nine at the time of the ruling in 2012, and then as I was reporting this book, I never got the feeling that any quid pro quo was stated out loud, that he never said directly to Justices Kagan and Breyer, "Switch your vote and I'll switch mine." In fact, I'm pretty convinced he never said that. He never really had to say that. Once he started to move in their direction and cast a different kind of vote that they knew was going to hold him up to a lot of criticism and that he would have to pay for in some way, they, on their own, through subtle encouragement, thought, we can move a little bit too. And they didn't think that it would be as consequential as it ended up being. Because just to remind listeners, Congress had told the states that they needed to expand their Medicaid coverage, but Congress, the federal government, was going to pay for almost all of it. So the court and many people who had sponsored the law thought, what states would say no to this? Well, as we know, many Republican states did say no to that. More states have now expanded their Medicaid coverage, But what John Roberts wrote was that the original provision was essentially holding a gun to the head of the state.
My guest is CNN legal analyst Joan Biskupic. We're talking about her book, The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is CNN legal analyst Joan Biskupic, whose new book is The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. If you'd like to be part of a conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send a message to us on Twitter. We're at KERATHINK. Joan, let's talk about the climate in which John Roberts formed his conservative beliefs. He was raised with privilege. It seems like he never used that as an excuse to work hard, even from childhood.
Oh, no. He was a very studious young boy and did very well at school. One of the early anecdotes I got from a relative was how mother was, you know, bragging about him getting all A's. And it wasn't that it was effortless. He worked very hard. His classmates recall him, you know, studying early in the morning, studying late at night. In college, always had a bottle of Pepto-Bismol in hand, just worked very, very hard and would sometimes have a lot of stress attached to that, but did extremely well. He was number one at his boarding class in a boarding school class in northern Indiana. He goes to Harvard for undergrad, finishes undergrad in 3 years, goes right into Harvard Law School. You know, throughout his time in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you know, won awards for his writing. He was on the Law Review. He was managing editor. And then earns two very prestigious judicial clerkships, one with an appeals court judge on the Second Circuit, Henry Friendly, who was one of the greatest judges of his era, and then at the U.S. Supreme Court with William Rehnquist, mm-hmm. who was then an associate justice. So he went first class all the way, but he worked very hard for it.
So he did his undergrad and his law degree both at Harvard. How did his politics compare with the broader climate he found at the university at the time?
He was put off by the liberalism. He had been raised in a pretty conservative home, and he had always had views that were on the right. And when he gets to Harvard, it's the first time that he's really exposed to such strong liberalism, and he's put off by it. And he says that he doesn't get involved in any of the political debates of the day. At first, he was actually studying to be a history professor. He originally thought he might go on for a PhD in history. But back in the 70s, there was a real glut of PhDs in history, you know, and professors, and he was encouraged to find something different. And even when he went to law school, at first he thought he might teach, but instead he, of course, went on to be a litigator, an appellate litigator. But one thing I should tell you, you ask about his resistance to the liberal culture of the 60s and 70s, which he did resist when he was a younger man. But just as he's graduating from Harvard Law School and about to get these judicial clerkships and, you know, emerging in a professional life, conservatism is in ascendance. Hmm. Ronald Reagan wins in November of 1980. And when he gives his inaugural speech in January of 1981, John Roberts, still, you know, in his 20s, hears it and says, "I felt the call." He immediately wants to be part of the new Reagan administration.
And he was part of the Reagan administration and then a part of the George H.W. Bush administration after that.
That's exactly right. And it's like he blossomed. To read the memos that he wrote for Ronald Reagan and then George H.W. Bush's people for their legal teams is to see someone who's very confident, pushing an agenda much more than someone would have suspected, because I think personally he's very reserved and shy, and he still exudes a modest manner. But back then, the agenda, so to speak, of both of those administrations touched something in his beliefs, and he responded in kind.
So I want to play here a clip of him during his Senate confirmation hearing to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. I want to listen to his response to the late Senator Ted Kennedy's question about work that he had done during the Reagan administration in 1982.
Senator, you will recall
at the time of the, this was 23 years ago, I was the staff lawyer in the Justice Department. It was the position of the Reagan administration for whom I worked, the position of the Attorney General for whom I worked, that the Voting Rights Act should be extended for the longest period of its extension in history without change. The Supreme Court had interpreted in the Mobile versus Bolden case Section 2 to have an intent test, not an effects test. Keep in mind, of course, as you know very well, Section 5, the preclearance provision, had always had an effects test, and that would be continued. The reference to discrimination nationwide was addressing the particular point that the effects test had been applied in particular jurisdictions that had a history of discrimination. And the question is whether or not there was a similar history of discrimination that supported extending the effects test in Section 2. It was the position of the administration for which I worked that the proposal was to extend the Voting Rights Act without change. Your position at the time was that the intent test that the Supreme Court had determined was in Section 2 should be changed to the effects test, and that was the position that eventually prevailed.
It turned out to be a really prescient question by Senator Kennedy about something that would very much, a policy that would very much be a part of Roberts' life as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
That's so true. One thing I write in my book is that I really believe that there's a through line in Roberts' life, and that's his opposition to racial remedies. From his Reagan years to, you know, rulings that definitely affect people there in Texas that he's had a hand in, but also the 2013 Shelby County versus Holder Voting Rights Act case. He has always felt that racial remedies do more harm than good. He famously said in a 2007 school integration case, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. And the thing about that exchange that you just aired, Chris, between John Roberts and Senator Kennedy at the time, is that he wanted to separate himself. John Roberts wanted to separate himself from what he did for the Reagan administration to say, look, I was just a young lieutenant. I was following someone else's orders here. These were not my ideas. And maybe they weren't. Maybe he didn't start out that way. Maybe he was just being an excellent junior officer. But we see since then that he personally holds many of those ideas. And maybe they were just in sort of an incubator stage then. But that his views on race, the Voting Rights Act, school integration issues, campus affirmative action, thinking about issues there at the University of Texas at Austin, he has been so consistent in those areas and consistent in a way that arguably revealed themselves back in the early 80s when he worked for Ronald Reagan. And, you know, Ted Kennedy knew that.
So he's been consistent. He actually has a consistently unorthodox perspective on his interpretation of the Brown v. Board decision. Can you talk about that?
Oh, that is so true. It's so interesting because that's where he and Justice Kennedy didn't like racial remedies much either, but those two went into separate camps in a very important 2007 case that involved school integration plans. And the two disputes, they involved the Louisville and Seattle school districts. And they arose from attempts by those school districts to counteract the return of school segregation caused by whites and blacks living in separate parts of the city. So both of those districts had tried to create assignment plans that did look at students' race, but to integrate them, not to separate them. And John Roberts voted to strike down the plans, voicing a very clear idea about what he thought Brown v. Board of Education stood for. He said that that landmark, which examined segregated children, also applied to plans for integrating school children. And I'm glad you asked about it. I happen to have the line he wrote there. He, in that 2007 case, he wrote, before Brown v. Board of Education in 54, school children were told where they could and could not go to school based on the color of their skin. And then he goes on to say, the school districts in these cases have not carried their heavy burden of demonstrating that we should allow this once again, even for different reasons. So he's for legal, constitutional reasons, he's equating school segregation plans and school integration plans. And just as Kennedy, who, as I said, you know, often voted with the chief on questions of race, he not only separated himself from Chief Justice Roberts in the writing, but he also spoke from the bench in this case saying, you know, this is wrong, the way he's reading Brown v. Board of Education. And he says at one point something to the effect of 50 years of experience since Brown v. Board of Education should teach us that the problem before us defies such an easy solution as the chief is suggesting here. And he said the enduring hope is that race should not matter, but the reality is that too often it does. So when the Chief Justice says the way to stop discrimination based on race is to stop discriminating based on race, Justice Kennedy stops him and says, wait, it's still too early to just turn away from all that. And their schools still need to take some measures. Now, in that particular case, that big 2007 case that's collectively known as Parents Involved versus Seattle Schools, Justice Kennedy did vote to say that the school districts had not done enough to try race-neutral remedies and other plans, but he definitely did not agree with the legal rationale that Chief Justice Roberts was advocating here.
My guest is CNN legal analyst Joan Biskupic. Her book is The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So Roberts has clashed with his colleagues now and then, Joan, notably with Justice Sotomayor, who's been candid about drawing on her personal life experiences to inform her legal positions. Why does Roberts disapprove of that? And does he not recognize that his own personal life experiences might, in fact, inform his legal positions?
I think he believes that his life experiences do not inform his legal positions. And I've written that, for Justice Sotomayor, her background is foreground. And for the chief, he is insistent that it's not part, that he's just looking at the law, as I said, calling balls and strikes. And it is quite a clash. And it's come up in, you know, university affirmative action issues. It's come up on race across the board, even when race is a subtle dimension and when it's right there on the front burner. And the chief, there was a 2014 case, it happened to be from Michigan, where the two of them kind of came to a head, even though, you know, the other justices had resolved the case, they had written their opinions, but Justice Sotomayor, writing for the dissent, really struck out at the Chief Justice's philosophy, and she did it in this kind of sly way, turning that mantra that I've repeated a couple times right now to you, Chris, the idea of the way to stop discrimination based on race is to stop discriminating based on race. Mm-hmm. She sort of twisted that against him and said, I don't have it right in front of me, but it's something like the way to stop discrimination based on race is to talk openly about the issue, to talk about the problems of it. And the tone of her dissent there in that case from 2014 was a little bit like, you don't get it kind of tone.
Right.
And he ends up writing a separate statement signed only by himself, lashing back at her, saying, you know, suggesting these are just policy arguments and to debate these things the way I'm debating them is not to be clueless here. So it was a very tense moment. And rarely does the chief like to reveal that side of himself. He usually doesn't write separately. He keeps it in check. But she had just provoked him a little too much there.
So it was a personal rebuke.
Yes, it was.
So you've sat with him. I know a lot of it was off the record, but you've sat with him for 20 hours. Does he acknowledge any influence on his own beliefs of the fact that he happens to be, about as dominant a member of the dominant culture as you can get? He's a white, male, wealthy American. Does he acknowledge that at least could have shaped how he sees the world?
If he had acknowledged that to me off the record, I wouldn't tell you. But let me just tell you that there's no temptation for me to tell you that he's
you don't have anything to off the record here.
No,
this.
Okay. I do not think he thinks of himself as a jurist in those terms. Mm-hmm. That's all I can say about that. But it's so interesting. The sense of identity that each of these individual justices have. And some of them, as you just mentioned about Justice Sotomayor, much more self-reflective. And, I have to say, let's pick a conservative so we're not just, singling out a conservative versus liberal. Justice Scalia, who I spent so much time with, I had 12 on-the-record interviews with him, I felt that he was self-aware. He certainly was self-centered in a lot of ways too, but he sort of owned his identity, and he would be for better or for worse. I think what you saw was what you got. And now, there are plenty of people thought, well, what I see is not what I want for an American justice, but he at least responded to, he would acknowledge himself in the kind of the whole culture he was part of. Although I do have to say, on the Catholicism issue that you had raised earlier, Justice Scalia was adamant that his own Catholicism, he was a very deep believer, a Roman Catholic believer, that did not influence his opinions, that he came to those irrespective of his Catholic beliefs. But certainly they aligned with his Catholic beliefs.
Why would Roberts stay off the record with you for 20 hours? I mean, like or hate his decisions, he has, by all accounts, had an honorable record.
I was really disappointed in the limited access he gave. I think in the end, he felt that he was much more cooperative than he had intended to be. In fact, he said that he felt like he was much more cooperative than he intended to be. He resisted this from the start. I have to say, one of the reasons I wanted to do this at this point in his life, because a lot of people have said, well, why would you do it so early in his tenure? Well, first of all, he has been so important for the country. Only 17 chief justices of the United States when we've had 45 presidents.
Okay, let me jump in quickly. I know there's more time here that you'll need to fill, and I want to make sure that you have it. My guest is CNN legal analyst. We're talking about her book, The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts, back in two. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with CNN legal analyst Joan Biskupic about her book, The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. And before the break, Joan, you were telling us why you would choose to do this book at this moment in Roberts' tenure.
Yes, Chris. Plenty of people say, why him and why now? And frankly, the chief was constantly saying, why me and why now? But let me tell you exactly why. When I started this book, it was late 2015, and Antonin Scalia was still alive, and Anthony Kennedy was in control of the court. And I thought that the Chief Justice Roberts was very relevant then. I wanted to get to the bottom of what he had done on the Affordable Care Act case. I wanted to show people this pattern on race. I wanted to talk about other culture war issues. But in the process of working on this book, he only became much more important. He is now not just the Chief Justice of the United States, he is the controlling vote at the ideological center of this court. So I felt that people needed to know more about him, even though his entire tenure wasn't done. So, and the other thing I should make clear to all your listeners is I'm not a historian. I'm a journalist, and I'm trying to do this as more of a public affairs effort to show what's going on now with the contemporary court. Not this day, not this week, not this year, but this time, this era with our contemporary court. The other thing is, I am not too many years younger than Chief Justice Roberts. And if I were to wait until he was long gone, I would be long gone. And I frankly thought, I'm positioned to do this book. I watch him on a daily basis. I have the context of having written about colleagues of his. I have had wonderful access to his colleagues who've told me things along the way, beginning in 2005 when he was appointed. So it's a good thing to do now. And it's harder when you don't have more complete cooperation, as I did, for example, with Justice Scalia. But you do the best you can with the material you have. And, you know, a majority of his colleagues talk to me. So I feel like I was able to flesh out stories as I went along.
For people who don't follow the high court nearly as closely as you do, can you just elaborate for us on how the powers and the duties of the Chief Justice differ from those of his eight colleagues on the court?
Sure. And that's a great question because he's commonly known as first among equals. His vote only counts, you know, 1/9, like all the rest of them. But he's the one who runs things. He runs the oral arguments. He runs their private conferences. And he essentially sets the agenda. He says, you know, this is what the case is about. And he starts the discussion. So, you know, I should remind everyone about what an effective oral advocate he was. He argued 39 times before the Supreme Court. He's known for his persuasive powers. So he's starting off all the discussions in his role as chief. And then once all the votes are cast, if he's with the majority, as he more often than not is, he is in charge of deciding who gets to write the opinion. And the opinion and its legal reasoning matters far beyond the dispute that's right in front of the justices. You know, the vote will determine who wins and who loses, but it's the legal reasoning that the author of the opinion weaves in and gets support from his or her colleagues on that dictate how future cases will turn out. So that's a lot of power. He also oversees the third branch. So all federal judges, you know, at the Supreme Court level, the U.S. Courts of Appeal level, and then the district court judges essentially feed up in a bureaucracy that Chief Justice John Roberts presides over.
It's not a secret that the late Justice Scalia had imagined serving as Chief Justice himself. Did it affect their relationship in any way that Roberts sort of leapfrogged over being Associate Justice and straight into the Chief Justice position?
Well, I don't think Justice Scalia was crazy about that. But he also was a realist. You know, he said, you know, look at my age. I think he hoped that it could be in the cards for him, and it wasn't. He obviously, you know, was older, and he understood the politics of judicial nominations. Not only would he have not been able to have served as long as a young man who was, just to give an example of them, Justice Scalia was born in 1936. Chief Justice John Roberts was born in 1955. So mm-hmm. We had a generation separating them. So, you know, Justice Scalia, I think, understood it wouldn't have been in the cards. But he couldn't have helped but hope for it. And I think that their relationship started off pretty good, though. You know, they both had similar priorities in cases. I know that there was some tension. There certainly was during the Affordable Care Act case, and then also another Affordable Care Act case that followed the 2012 one that came in 2015, where again Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the majority and Justice Scalia was in dissent. So there was friction here and there, but not anything too serious.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. McKenna is calling us from Athens, Texas. Hi, McKenna.
Hello. I have a question about the decision in the Affordable Care Act. I always thought it was kind of politically motivated due to the fact that Justice Roberts used the taxation power of the Congress in sort of contradiction to what it can be used for. It's strictly limited to three areas of taxation, and to put it into the category of paying personal insurance premiums seems to me quite a stretch.
Thanks for calling.
Well, the caller puts his finger on something that the critics talked about is, you know, that it and that Chief and that Justice Scalia also complained about. He referred to it as sort of a fly-by-night approach to the taxing power. And there were arguments that, you know, maybe the Chief Justice's approach wasn't entirely coherent or consistent, but it was the product of, you know, a bit of a compromise, a bit of rationalization, but not out of the blue. As I said earlier, the Obama administration was saying that the Affordable Care Act could be upheld based on Congress's taxing power. So it was not far-fetched. It's just that it wasn't center stage, and there were some flaws in the consistency of the approach. But, you know, I've seen stranger things happen up there. So it wasn't so entirely out of the blue, but it certainly gave John Roberts' critics some ammunition.
Does Roberts see the defeat of his side in Obergefell v. Hodges as a particularly significant loss?
Boy, that's an excellent question. Just to remind everyone, that was the 2015 case that declared for the first time a fundamental constitutional right to same-sex marriage. And Chris, I just want to remind everyone that in that case, John Roberts used his first and only dissent from the bench to complain about that decision. When justices dissent from the bench, it's really an extraordinary moment because usually they just write their protests on paper and, you know, in their dissenting opinions, and that's the end of it. And some justices, including the chief, think, oh, that's such a dramatic thing to do, to dissent from the bench. But that's the one case he chose to do that in, to say, I think this is wrong, what you and the majority have done. Just to remind everyone, it was an opinion by Justice Anthony Kennedy saying that there is this right for gay men to marry each other, lesbians to marry each other, and that's how we're going to read the guarantees of the Constitution. And the chief scoffed at that in so many ways and even compared it to the Dred Scott ruling of, you know, ages ago that, you know, first said that, you know, Negroes were not citizens and could not challenge the conditions of their slavery. So it was a huge deal for the chief to invoke Dred Scott and to put down the majority ruling with such anger and with such a dramatic moment in the courtroom.
It's interesting to think that his argument in support of sort of traditional marriage being the only way that we would define this kind of union is him saying that gays and lesbians were not, in fact, prevented from marrying, the implication being that they're welcome to marry someone of the opposite sex.
Yeah, and he said his argument was that this is something that should be left to the states. It should not be left to, as at one point in his dissenting opinion, he referred to five lawyers, the five justices in the majority. So he pinned it on, you know, the limited reach of the judicial power and the U.S. Constitution. And you're right that he invoked much about traditional marriage definitions through the years, biblical age-old definitions. And it did show that, you know, all things considered, he's relatively young, and many younger people have come to accept same-sex marriage much more than older people, but John Roberts was pretty fixed in his view there.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You mentioned that he's relatively young, Joan. He also has quite young children for someone of his age. I wonder what you were able to learn about the dynamics of his personal life and how he sort of keeps the ship running at home when he's got this job that takes up so much of his time and energy.
Well, those children who were once very young and who were on display in 2005 when he was nominated, and some might remember that his son Jack actually danced a bit before the cameras in a Spider-Man routine. They're now. Let's see. They were both born in 2000. Jane Roberts, the chief's wife, sat for two pretty extensive interviews, both on the record, and was very helpful with their family life and what it was like. And both of those children were adopted in 2000. One, Josie, as she's named, in July, and Jack in December. So they're both turning 19 this year, you know. So and one of them is already in college. The daughter is already in college, and the son is finishing up high school at a boarding school. So they're both launched. John Roberts and his wife Jane are empty nesters, but you know, early on, as I was obviously tracking him soon after he became chief, you know, he had, you know, the same kind of duty of taking the kids, you know, to their various sporting events, you know, their singing events, and their, you know, they went, one of them, the daughter went to school right there in the Washington, D.C. area, suburban Maryland. The son, as is easily public knowledge because of John Roberts' commencement address at the, one of the son's boarding schools, he went to a boarding school fairly early on, but they were in the neighborhood, and occasionally I would actually see them because I don't live too far from where he's at. But, you know, he had the same kind of parental responsibilities that many of your listeners had. But it's a little tougher when you're being driven to work by security, and you have obligations as the top judicial officer of the United States.
Do you think, were there ever instances in which you got the sense that Roberts was being particularly candid with you because your conversations with him would remain off the record? Or was he guarded even knowing that that you had agreed not to state anything in the book that he didn't give you permission to state?
I was always aware of him trying to find out information from me and trying to shape my perceptions. Mm-hmm. In fact, as the lawyers in your audience will know, there's that what they engage in discovery, right, in litigation, trying to figure out, you know, what they can get in terms of documents and interviews and an understanding of what the opposite side's position is. And some of his fellow justices would say to me, why do you think he's even meeting with you? Because they knew that he was resisting this project. And I often felt that he was trying to figure out what I was learning from others, where I was headed. And actually, Chris, I wanted him to know where I was headed because I wanted him to be aware of what I was finding out. And I wanted his response so I could build in his reactions. You know, I showed him. You know, I told him all along, you know, what I was finding out about the Affordable Care Act negotiations, how I was viewing his patterns on racial remedies. And, you know, in the end, I showed him the table of contents, and I, you know, made sure a close friend of his had seen the book early, and, you know, all sorts of things. So I needed information from him, but I was also aware that he might need information from me. But then the other thing is, I was always aware of him as advocate. You know, you are thinking of him as Chief Justice of the United States, but I was remembering having covered him from all those years when he would be this stellar persuader before the justices. And, you know, the justices themselves talked about him being the gold standard. So I was aware that I could be on the receiving end of his persuasive abilities. So to answer your question, did I ever think he really dropped his guard? Not really. But it's okay. That's, you know, he's, I think that's human nature.
Joan Biskupic is a legal analyst for CNN and author of the new biography, The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. Joan, it's been a really interesting hour. Thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Chris.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think and use your favorite podcast app to become a subscriber to the Think podcast. Our website is think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.